The program you're about to hear has content that may be offensive to some of you. I frankly found the title offensive when I first heard it, but then I listened to the content of the show and found it worthy. I suggest you do the same. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
You have the risk of being seen as both a jerk or, let's say, so you can bleep it, an asshole.
Hey, George.
The ocean called. They're running out of shrimp.
Oh, yeah, Riley? Well, the jerk store called. They're running out of you.
What's the difference? You're their all-time bestseller.
I'm just a regular Joe with a regular job. I'm your average white suburbanite slob. I like football and porno and books about war. I got an average house with a nice hardwood floor. My wife and my job, my kids and my car. My feet on my table and a Cuban cigar.
But sometimes that just ain't enough to keep a man like me interested.
Oh no,
no way,
No,
I've gotta go out and have fun at someone else's expense.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. I drive really slow in the ultra fast lane while people behind me are going insane.
Some people are just hard to get along with. They make everything difficult. They're, well, I can't say the word on public broadcasting, but starts with an A and kind of rhymes with castle. You know the one I mean. Today, the word we can't say. Where it came from, what being one means, and, most important, how to deal with someone who's just a big... First, the word itself. We're going to have to cut it out during the next hour. A lot. But, well, let's see how far we can get. Talking about the word we can't hear, beginning with linguist Jeffrey Nunberg, author of a book called, well, I'm going to let him tell you the title of his book.
It's Ascent of the A Word, and the subtitle is Assholism, the First 60 Years. I feel this is a serious book, though it has its moments of levity, about a serious subject. I didn't want to seem to be doing a kind of nudge-nudge thing. So, in fact, it was only with a certain reluctance that I even used the A word with an ism tacked onto it.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, it's a word that I don't like much. I've used it, and I've certainly heard it used, and I think the discussion of what it means and why is fascinating. But I also think that probably for the course of our conversation, we want to say something else, and maybe the A word is enough.
I think the A word should be enough. Look, this is a vulgar word. It's a coarse word. It disturbs even people who really don't have those qualms about using the F word or the S word or other words of that nature. And it's supposed to be a coarse word. If it weren't a coarse word, it wouldn't do the work we ask of it. We wouldn't have anything to yell at the guy who starts his leaf blower at 7 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Yes, I think probably the word is applicable in that particular situation.
There are plenty of times when this is just the word you want because it expresses your disdain and your contempt for somebody with a kind of coarseness that does real semantic work.
Was that what you were thinking about when you decided to write this book?
I was interested in language like this because it's words like these that, in a certain sense, betray our real attitudes. When people talk about a word like incivility, for example, they're almost invariably not going to tell you what they're really thinking. It's a word that's cut out for op-ed pages and so on. When people use the A word, they're expressing genuine feelings and feelings they don't really think about much, which makes it all the more accurate as an indication of these attitudes.
Yeah. How do you define it? Can you define it?
You can define it as someone with an obtuse refusal to acknowledge what the situation requires. That's an abstract definition. I think it's better defined by example. When you ask somebody to define the word, they start giving you a list of names. They don't go to Webster.
Yeah.
There's a case I use, for example. A friend from Texas finds himself in New York on 9/11. got to get home to his family, freaked out, goes to the Hertz rental place. It's jammed with people with the same idea he has, beleaguered clerks. And this little guy comes into the room and walks to the front of the room and pulls out his wallet and says, excuse me, can you tell me where the gold card line is? Everybody in that room had the same three-word sentence in his head, and the third word was not boor, right?
Yeah.
So it demonstrates these properties I'm talking about. There's an obtuseness there. This guy's not evil or malign. He's just obtuse.
Yeah. In fact, at one point in the book, you talk about culpable obtuseness.
A culpable obtuseness. He should know better. That's one reason why we don't use the A word, for example, of little children. They can merit the S word because there's a malignity that's innate in little kids sometimes. But you can't merit the A word until you're old enough so that you ought to know better.
Yeah.
And this guy in that Hertz place should have known better and was just occluding from himself the realities of the situation so he could take advantage of a little piece of plastic that gave him, he thought, particular privileges in this setting.
You know what I liked about that explanation and the one that you give similarly in the book is the next piece of it. Somebody behaves like that and it gives us permission to use the word because they're so obviously the A word.
And when we use the word, we're being uncivil ourselves. It's an uncivil response to incivility. That's one of the things that fascinates me about it, because you can't use this word without swearing at somebody. And in a certain sense, it gives us license to treat that person badly, to disrespect that person, often with reason, like this guy in the Hertz place. But often we depict the other person as an A-word precisely so that we can have the pleasure of being uncivil, of being a jerk back at them.
But being uncivil back at them, using the A word back at them, it is more like being a jerk than, at least in the way I look at myself, being the A word.
No, I think that's right. And I think one of the problems, particularly in public life, is that there's this kind of reciprocal A wordism where you depict the people on the other side as people who merit this label, and that gives you the right to behave in the same way back at them. And I think that's the animating principle, for example, of cable talk shows. Political discourse in particular. We depict those guys as people who merit the A word, as effete, full of themselves, out of touch, pretentious, and so on. And that gives us the right to be Dirty Harry back at them.
It is interesting, though, isn't it? Because you talk about the cable people, and in fact, it can be the people on either side of an issue, depending on where you are.
Right. The word and the concept license a certain incivility. And when people complain about the incivility of public discourse, which they do all the time, I think this is really what they're complaining about. People say that this is a more uncivil age than previous ages, but the historians point out, no, they were talking that way during the McCarthy years, during the Roosevelt years. Anybody who's seen the film Lincoln, which accurately depicts the tone of political rhetoric of that period, can see that they were just as uncivil as we were. But we're uncivil in different ways. And in particular, this kind of A-wordism, this reciprocal nastiness, performed mostly for the enjoyment of our partisans. That's a new note in American political life.
Is it really, or is it just that it seems more vulgar than the kind of political rhetoric that was true a century or two ago? Because I've read that the political rhetoric at the time of the Founding Fathers was pretty nasty.
It's always been nasty, and at times much nastier than it is now. I think there is a difference, though. A character like Westbrook Pegler, the acerbic columnist of the Roosevelt years, could say things about Roosevelt or about the Jews that would just be beyond the pale in contemporary political rhetoric in anywhere in public life. But he would not have thought to say of the 9/11 widows, as Ann Coulter did, that they were enjoying their husband's deaths. Not because he wasn't capable of that kind of cruelty, but because it wouldn't have occurred to him that there was any rhetorical point to it. And I think that's the difference, that people are now gratuitously nasty and abusive, not really to get at the other people, and not really because they hate these people, but because of the pleasure their own partisans take in imagining how indignant it makes the other side to hear that.
You know, one of the interesting things about that, it strikes me, is that in that instance you just described, where Ann Coulter did, as you say, refer to the widows of the 9/11 victims as enjoying that, it springs to mind immediately to use the A word. And that is unusual because it doesn't fit women very often.
You know, some people say, oh, well, women can't be A words. I think that's true of some other terms that are more closely connected to parts of the male anatomy. But in the case of women, It's true that we rarely use the word of women, but there are various reasons for that. One is that, well, it's a word we tend to use of powerful people, and powerful people are more often men still nowadays. Also, men who are in powerful positions tend to be the kinds of people who walk around saying, "Do you know who I am?" which was a characteristic A-word thing to do. But there's another reason that I think is more interesting, which is that when a woman does the sort of thing that would earn a man the A-word label, bellows at the agent at the check-in desk in the airport, "You know how much money my company spends? How come you're not giving me an upgrade?" and so on. When a woman does that, we're much more likely to use another word, the B-word, as if suddenly this was not something that followed from just an undue sense of entitlement, but rather from some primordial feminine nastiness. And there's a kind of sexism in that, I think, genuinely. If we were more interested in gender equity, we would call women with the A-word much more frequently than we do.
Do you think that any of this has to do with the anatomical nature of the A-word? Is it something that is more easily talked about in modern times than it was 100 years ago?
Well, the word itself is a new word, like a lot of these vulgar terms that we use to describe people. It's coined in the mouths of GIs during World War II. In fact, the first military leader to earn the label was General Patton, from both his men and his superiors. It enters the language around 1970, and there is a sense, certainly, in which we're using these anatomical terms for the first time in the English language to describe people. It's also something that is particularly regarded as something that's small and dirty and hidden and dark. And that certainly colors the way we think of people when we use this word. It's an expression of contempt. It makes them small and in some way vile or infected.
It's interesting to realize that it only came into common usage in the 70s, and it really only surfaced in the slang of World War II GIs. I would have thought it was earlier than that, but you say it was actually Norman Mailer who introduced it to literature for the first time.
Well, the first literary character to bear this description appears in The Naked and the Dead, Norman Mailer's 1948 novel, really written earlier than that, about World War II. And it was a word that appeared first in the mouths of World War II GIs. But it really isn't until the 70s, as you say, that you start seeing it in Woody Allen movies and Neil Simon plays, that you get a film series like Dirty Harry, where this word figures centrally. It's really there that it becomes part of the American moral repertory. And that's one reason it's particularly interesting to me, because I think that one has to examine the words of one's moral life, if only to be able to control them and to be able to think reflectively on them. And this is very much a part of our moral life. It may be a word we disdain and we think is coarse, but as we go through our day, we're classifying people, and this is one of the important classifications we use.
Did Mailer's use of the word change things? I mean, how did its use in that novel influence the word's development later on? Do you think it was influential in its spread?
No, I don't really think so. I think it's in this moment that you start to see this kind of language used widely in a certain kind of fiction, naturalistic fiction about soldiers and crime and so on and so forth. When Herman Wouk published The Caine Mutiny a couple of years later, it was notable for not having used any of that language. The reviewers mentioned it. So by then, it was almost obligatory in a novel of this type. It's striking that the word doesn't appear in The Catcher in the Rye. Holden Caulfield, had this book been written 20 years later, would surely have called a lot of people with the A-word that he instead designated as phonies.
Yeah.
So it's coming into general usage around this period, but it really, as I say, isn't until the late 60s, the 70s, that it just becomes an ordinary word. It's no longer slang. It's just the first word that comes to mind when somebody who merits that label crosses your line of sight.
And it's fascinating, isn't it? As good a book as Catcher in the Rye is, and Holden Caulfield, what an incredible character, that seems wrong somehow. Phony isn't a strong enough word for what he's referring to, whereas the A word would fit pretty well.
Well, except that Holden Caulfield in that era would not have used the A word. It doesn't appear in any John O'Hara novels, and O'Hara certainly has his characters using very strong language. Holden would have used phony, as Allen Ginsberg did. Phony was a very strong word, a condemnation of the immediate post-war period. It's only later, when you get words like the A-word coming in, that it's driven, so to speak, to the moral margins, as is heel, another word that seems to us
quaint, almost.
Quaint, but the characters played by Zachary Scott and Mildred Pierce and Dan Duryea and Frank Sinatra in Pal Joey, those are real movie heels. And they, too, are renamed with the A-word in the early 70s, as first by feminists and then by women in general. It isn't as if men have changed or men are no longer doing these things, but there's a new diagnosis of what they're doing. And that's really what's happening when this word moves into the language and drives those other words to the margins.
Thinking about this, it just amused me to realize that in 1970, when it wasn't so well used, we had the age of Aquarius. Maybe this is the age of the A word.
I think it is. I think that the category itself exercises a kind of fascination for us. I went to look at the lists of most fascinating people that Barbara Walters compiles year after year. And every year, anywhere from 4 to 6 of the 10 are people who merit the A word. Last year, it was Steve Jobs, Trump, Simon Cowell, Herman Cain, the Kardashians, Derek Jeter. I think people could go either way on him. And then a few other people who don't merit the word. But historically, Mel Gibson and Tiger Woods and Trump always and James Cameron and Michael Moore, Glenn Beck, more than half of the people are people who are generally associated with this word. And that's a disproportion even for the worlds of sports and entertainment and politics from which he draws these people. So I think there's a fascination with these characters as characters. Every age picks a characteristic social abuser. It was the phony in the post-war years. It was the cad and the bounder in the age of Anthony Trollope, the Victorian period. And I think the A word is ours.
There are a couple of ways to look at this, of course. One is just as words, and the other is the emotions that lie behind it. Linguists, as you are, spend a lot of time thinking about the question, does language shape thought or does thought shape language? Do you think that applies here? And if it does, how does it play out in the context of the A word?
I think it very much shapes the way we collectively think about the world. This word comes in sometime between the war and the 1970s. It drives out these other words like heel and phony or drives them to the margins. It classifies, reclassifies a group of people whose behavior may have been reprehensible 50 or 100 years ago, but whom we think about differently now because we have a word that says that the things that Donald Trump is doing and that Charlie Sheen is doing and that Ann Coulter is doing all are manifestations of the same kind of behavior, which we wouldn't have thought of 40 years ago.
You've trolled the language quite a lot. You've used Google extensively. Is there any other word that is making a play to take the place of the A word?
Well, there are always these variants. There's the A hat and the A wipe and so on and so forth that have always been around. All of these words are out there, and it's really the concept that I'm interested in, that these words signal more than the word itself. In fact, other languages have other words to do this. The British use something like the A word with arse instead of ass. But they also have words like wanker and tosser and git and so on and so forth, which we can say on American radio. In Italian, they have the word stronzo, which is literally a turd. In Mexican Spanish, they have pendejo, which is a pubic hair. All of them doing more or less the work that the A word does in the English language. And all of them new words, 20th century words formed from vulgar notions. So I don't know that it's the word itself, but rather this sensibility that it announces. That's really the interesting thing. The word is more of an indicator than the thing of interest itself.
Jeffrey Nunberg is the author of Ascent of the A-Word. So, how much do you use the A-Word? And if you try to steer clear, do you have a favorite euphemism you use in its place? You can send us a message on our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, an interview with a guy who's famous for being a, well, you know. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you're a regular listener to Fresh Air, you've probably heard Terry Gross's 2002 interview with KISS rocker Gene Simmons. In full makeup, a garish costume, and 7-inch platform boots, Simmons has made millions of dollars portraying a demon on stage. So it's no surprise Terry's interview with him went the way it did.
Money is the single most important thing on the planet.
How much money do you have?
Gee, a lot more than NPR.
No, let's get to the studded cod piece. Do you have a sense of humor about that? I mean, does that seem funny to you? Or you?
No, it holds in my manhood. Otherwise,
right.
It would be too much for you to take. You'd have to put the book down and confront life. The notion is that if you want to welcome me with open arms, I'm afraid you're also going to have to welcome me with open legs.
That's a really obnoxious thing to say.
No, it's not. Why should I say something behind your back that I can't tell you your face? How does it feel to be real and whole? You're such a creep. You look like a sheep. Your job and my job, whether you wear less makeup and I wear more makeup, is to entertain people. And I'm here to tell you, I'm very entertaining. I don't know about you, but this is NPR.
What exactly is NPR in your mind?
I never knew. It always sounds like a sixth grade school teacher. See, if I was in charge, give me the reins, I would get national public radio. People start snoring. How about some style? Give me a little spice instead of this bland. I was in Los Angeles and did a quick one. And the instructor, you know, the DJ guy gets on, "Good afternoon, Gene." Going, "What's the matter? Why are you talking like that? What do you mean?" As a listener, well, I would beg you guys to get something else on the air. Something with style. I change the call letters, NPR. I change it. Give it some oomph, Lexus, Locus, something.
That the personality you've presented on our show today is a persona that you've affected as a member of KISS, something that you do on stage and before the microphone, but that you're not nearly as obnoxious in the privacy of your own home or when you're having dinner with friends.
Fair enough. And I'd like to think that the boring lady who's talking to me now is a lot sexier and more interesting than the one who's doing NPR. You know, studious and reserved. And I bet you're a lot of fun at a party.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Gene Simmons,
sure.
Thanks so much.
I look forward to our meeting.
Bye-bye.
That's part of Terry Gross's interview with Gene Simmons from a 2002 episode of Fresh Air. Truth is, jerks are everywhere. Think you can spend a nice, relaxing day at the beach without having to deal with any? Think again. Aaron James is an avid surfer, and one encounter on the water inspired him to write his book, Assholes, A Theory. James teaches philosophy at UC Irvine. He's created a taxonomy of jerks and blockheads, including the delusional A-word. He tells Steve Paulson why the hip-hop mogul Kanye West qualifies.
Delusional because I think that he's sort of mistaken in a deep way about his greatness. I mean, I think he's a very talented artist, but he thinks that he's, well, as he puts it, God made a path for him. So he sees himself as this very extraordinary, almost, you know, world historical kind of artist, a very grandiose conception of himself. And as a result of that, feels that he's entitled to do all kinds of things, partly being very rude, but lots of other famous mishaps. So that's delusional, not because he's wrong about his talent, but he's wrong about how talented he is, how important he is. And that's in a way related to his being wrong about what he feels entitled to. So there are other kinds of artists, say Picasso, who weren't delusional about how great they were, how important they were. I mean, Picasso was a truly important artist, but he was wrong about what that entitled him to. Even if, you know, great artists should get certain special privileges, Picasso arguably overstepped and asked too much.
And there's a long tradition of this, not just Picasso, Hemingway, Miles Davis. I mean, you know, run down the list of people who were great artists, but they often were kind of reprehensible in some of their dealings with other people.
Often the big mistake is not realizing how grateful they should be to larger society for giving them the gift of creative opportunity, without which they would have never achieved or been successful. I mean, artists who have to fend for food all the time or fend off, you know, foreign armies or whatever aren't going to get a lot of art done. But many of them, when they are successful and produce great artworks, everyone's very grateful for that. And then they sort of just take credit for it. You know, I did it, you know. And then they think even more should be coming to them or something like that than the sort of great benefits they've already got. So that can create a sense of entitlement.
Yeah. Well, there is also a psychiatric diagnosis for some of this kind of behavior, what is known as narcissistic personality disorder. Is that a dimension of a-holery?
I think that it's definitely closely related, although it could be that some people have narcissistic personality disorder who aren't necessarily A-words because maybe they have very, very low self-esteem, but and as a result become extremely self-absorbed. That might count as a narcissist, but that person might not be an A-word, for example. And there might be people who are A-words who it's not exactly narcissism or self-absorption that qualifies. The category narcissistic personality disorder isn't that well defined in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And in fact, I think it's being substantially edited and maybe even absorbed into a bigger category in the revisions of that manual right now. So from a philosophical point of view, you have to sort of just identify the different types as we see them. And then that'll line up with some of the psychiatric categories and sometimes not.
All the people we've mentioned so far as examples of being A-words are men, which raises the obvious question, can women be the A-word?
I think they can. I think they can in principle, although they're not nearly as common. Girls are mainly men. I think the convincing case for me is Ann Coulter. She's just clearly an A-word. it's kind of hard to see it another way, actually, partly because of her brazenness. She obviously does it because she's very savvily created a kind of media presence and a persona that gives her a lot of influence and gets a lot of attention. So it's not that she's completely aware. You know, she's very like savvy, intelligent woman. But her whole strategy is basically to present herself as a sort of ultra-aggressive A-word.
Well, there's also, there's a convention that we have, and it's funny because we were talking about this in the office here, and I was even talking about it with my 15-year-old son, and he said, no, girls can't be A-words. They're bitches.
Yeah, I think that's not true by definition. It's not necessarily true because there are terms like that, words that are essentially gendered by definition, like the term bachelor. Bachelors are by definition men. So if I were to say of Ann Coulter, she's a bachelor, that's sort of a misuse of language in a certain sense. I'm not understanding what the word bachelor means. Although if I say she's a spinster, it might not be true of her, but she could at least qualify because she's a woman, right? Or if you say of a man that he's a spinster, you've again misunderstood the words. But if you say of Ann Coulter that she's an A-word, that's an interesting possibility. And I say a reality. It's not sort of a misuse of the word itself. Although the truth in what you're suggesting, though, is that it turns out that when women have a similar kind of sense of entitlement, they'll often won't be as brazen about it, and they'll often qualify as a bitch instead, someone who sort of operates behind your back, maybe from a sense of entitlement, but isn't brazen or open about it. They'll recognize you to your face, as it were, but won't really give a lot of weight or listen to your complaints, you know, if you were to voice them.
So a bitch is not just the female equivalent of the male.
Yeah, men can be bitches as well.
Okay. Good to have that clarified. Now, you write that a newborn boy in the United States or Israel is much more likely to live the life of an A-word than a newborn boy in Japan or Norway or Canada. Why would that be?
First of all, I think there are A-words in every society, but to different degrees. And to a large extent, it's the culture of the society that shapes how much of the population are going to be A-words. So it just seems like there's certain kinds of societies like America or Italy or Israel where A-words just seem a lot more common, even adjusting for the differences in size of population and stuff like that.
Why? Why would some countries have greater numbers?
It seems like it's sort of a casual traveler anthropologist point of view, but you can also then at least speculate, you know, with different explanations. So if you go to Japan, for example, the strong collectivist culture makes for a very strong and palpable sense of politeness. And to the extent that somebody who is an A-word in Japan, which I'm sure they do exist, they would it'd be pretty suppressed and be pretty difficult for someone to be too brazen about it. But in some of the other countries we've mentioned, people are very overt and brazen about breaking cooperative norms and defensive about it.
Well, and you're also suggesting that in some of those countries, like, I don't know, United States or Italy, you don't necessarily suffer social sanctions by being so brazen.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the sort of a-holery is encouraged. People are proud of it in some of these cultures. So there's a culture of tolerance about it. It's even encouraged. It's prized. If you can get rich acting this way, then, well, you're successful. That's not true in other kinds of cultures, which have a more of a shame culture, for example. So there are those general cultural trends. And then you can look at specific trends within cultures that might be connected. Again, this is just speculation, but, you know, the rising tide of narcissism in the U.S. because of feel-good parenting styles, which parents protect their kids from bad consequences, or the rise of social media, which seems to induce narcissism and sort of that people are little celebrities. Those kinds of trends, you can at least tell a plausible story how, in conjunction with other trends, A-words are on the rise in society. I mean, also, I should mention a more obvious thing in the U.S. is the sort of greed is good style capitalism.
Well, I was going to say that because you actually have a chapter in your book called A-holery Capitalism. So are you suggesting that there's something inherent about the capitalist system that leads to this kind of obnoxious behavior?
I don't think it's inherent to capitalism per se, because any society can have sort of tendencies to create a-holes. And every kind of society is going to have sort of a-hole dampening systems, as I put it, to keep the a-hole population under control. And so definitely socialist or communist societies have these kinds of problems as well. But certain styles of capitalism are definitely prone to produce a-holes in greater numbers than, say, a different style of capitalism. So the greed is good style of capitalism, in effect, says that you're entitled to take as much as you can get from society without having to worry very much about contributing something. And so being greedy and acquisitive, just getting more and more, is supposed to be good overall for society. And so if it is, well, you can be greedy and just oblivious.
The Ayn Rand school of capitalism, basically. Selfishness will, in the end, cause more greater good.
That's the recent version of it. There is an older school of thought, which goes back to like Mandeville and Adam Smith, which suggests that, and David Hume as well, that private vice can lead to public virtue. And so it's a sort of deeper theme in the history of arguments for capitalism. But even those older versions of it, they just recognized that there was a kind of a tension there. It wasn't necessarily that there was a full-throated embrace of just outright greed or selfishness or a-holery, especially not conspicuously displayed. But that's the more recent version. We get more of a sense of that. And in fact, a sense that it's not only that selfish people get a pass because maybe they're doing good things. It's they feel sort of entitled to the rewards that they get and results or say are very against any kind of taxation or whatever, no matter how much good it will do for society, even if you need it to avoid a fiscal cliff or whatever, things like that, because they feel sort of righteously entitled to it. That's given by a certain understanding of what the message is in the type of capitalist society. So I think that kind of society does, well, attaches very powerful financial incentives for people to become and act like A-words.
Now, there is another dimension to this whole discussion, and that is, what do we do when we run into an A-word? Yeah, how do we deal with these people? And you have a large part of your book dealing with what you call A-word management. Any suggestions on how to respond?
Yes, I ultimately have some suggestions, but being a philosophical book, one of the main things I try to emphasize is just how difficult the problem is and that there's not, as it were, a 7 easy step to an a-hole free life.
That's the next book you should write, the follow-up. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. Right. I do, however, have 6 not so easy steps that help. There are things you can do. But the first sort of philosophical challenge, at least in a sort of one-to-one relation with an a-word, is to understand why we're so deeply bothered by the way that they treat us, when in fact the cost that they impose on us might be pretty small. So maybe we have to wait a couple minutes extra in line because they cut. So that's not a big deal in the big scheme of things. And yet at the same time, you might spend the rest of your day really upset about the brazen way in which this guy did that and who does he think he is and how could he not just wait and things like that. Or especially if you had an altercation, you know, when you piped up, the things he said might linger, you know, in your mind, spoiling your whole afternoon. So what is so upsetting about that to us? And so what I explain it is that we're not so worried about the lost time in line. We're really worrying about recognition or basic kind of respect that's extremely important to us. So the A word is basically putting us in a position so that we not only don't feel respected, we don't know how to do anything that would uphold our respect. So you feel like lashing out into a violent protest, say, or making a big argument, but in the end, that's not going to accomplish anything because A-words tend to be entrenched in their sense of entitlement. They won't listen. I mean, they are almost by definition walled off to almost anything you might say. Chances of getting through are slim. So we have a sense that it's completely pointless to stage an all-out fight for our rights. But on the other hand, the alternative seems then to be just sort of to completely acquiesce. And
to just get walked over, yeah.
Yeah, to get walked over and not stand up for yourself and almost implicitly admit that this is okay, you know, that I don't deserve better. So both of those reactions are extremely difficult to handle. So the real challenge is to just find an alternative, find a way of responding to the A word, a way of managing them such that you're accepting, fully accepting that they probably won't listen or change. And yet, so that you're not simply acquiescing, you're not simply giving in. And so the basic steps that you can do, sort of self-help-wise, are things along those lines. Like, well, one is just learning to accept that the guy probably won't listen or change. That's not an easy thing to do in the first instance. You can hope that the guy changes, and that can actually help you. And you might even be a little bit sympathetic to the person's being brought up poorly as a kid or whatever. If that helps you, be hopeful, you know, to see the person as a fellow person and not a sort of pure enemy. But even there, you want to be really careful not to be overly sympathetic so that you justify what the A word does. You have to still stay clear in yourself about your rights to better treatment.
I think a good way to conclude our conversation would be if you'd be willing to read a passage right at the end of your book.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so I was thinking page 187, the last paragraph there.
Okay. If humanity had a body, it would have an asshole, namely the asshole himself. Life invariably has a certain foulness, and he embodies it. All too often, fair is foul, and foul is fair. Yet the witches of social life cannot foretell our fates. Social life can be fairer and less foul if, but only if, cooperators of the world unite.
Aaron James is the author of Assholes, A Theory. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, the worst jerk is the one you can't avoid. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You may be wondering why anyone would want to devote an hour-long program, on public radio no less, to the A word. What kind of twisted mind dreamed up an entire hour on a word we're not really supposed to say on air? This might be a good moment to introduce today's producer, Doug Gordon.
A few months ago, I came across a quotation from the writer William Gibson. Quote, "Before you diagnose yourself with depression or low self-esteem, first, make sure that you are not, in fact, just surrounded by assholes." End quote. Actually, it turns out Gibson didn't say that. A guy named Stephen Winterburn did. Gibson just retweeted it. But my point is, that quote really resonates with me. Because I, along with several of North America's leading psychiatrists and mental hygienists, have diagnosed me as suffering from both depression and low self-esteem. But what if I don't really suffer from depression and low self-esteem? What if my problems are a direct result of the fact that I am surrounded by assholes? This could mark a real turning point in my life. Maybe I'm not really a suicidal candy ass after all. Maybe it's not too late for me to renounce my existential ways and pursue my goals and dreams. Of course, first I have to come up with some goals and dreams, but one thing at a time. All I have to do is stop surrounding myself with these assholes. But hold on a second. I'm a loner. I keep to myself. I'm hardly ever surrounded by anybody, let alone assholes. That can only mean one thing. I am the asshole? This would explain the incessant caterwauling of the inner voices in my head.
'Cause you're an asshole, you're an asshole, that's right. I'm an asshole, you're an asshole, you're an asshole, you're an asshole.
yes, yes, I'm an
So what should I do about this? Do I embrace my assholism or do I try to reform? Is there some kind of 12-step program? Assholes Anonymous? My name's Doug, and I'm an asshole. I just looked online, and there is an Assholes Anonymous. I better sign up, and I'll start attending meetings, and hopefully I'll be able to rid myself of my assholish ways. And even if it doesn't work and I continue to suffer from depression and low self-esteem, I'll have the perfect excuse. I'm surrounded by assholes. Spoken like a true asshole.
That's to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. It's relatively easy to avoid unpleasant characters in our social lives. In the office, that's a different story. Robert Sutton is a management professor at Stanford University. He's also the author of The No Asshole Rule, Building a Civilized Workplace and Surviving One That Isn't. He tells Anne Strangechamps when he first heard about the No A-Word Rule.
I possibly first heard about it, to go back to my father who did use the word, who told me not to be one probably when I was 4 or 5 years old. But where I think I really started living it was in my academic department. My department is now called Management Science and Engineering at Stanford. In an earlier incarnation, we were a small 12-person department. And there was this sort of magical moment where we were looking at the resume of a quite famous scholar. And somebody said, this guy's brilliant, but we don't want to hire him because he is, well, to use the word, a jerk. We sort of started this conversation that we were going to have the no a-hole rule in our department. And subsequently, probably for 10 or 12 years, we used that as a clear criteria. And I have to say that it made our department a much more civilized place to work. Also, there's other companies that I've been involved with that, although they don't necessarily use the word, they apply it in what they do. So Pixar's one. Google, they have a great saying. There's a woman named Shona Brown who was for a long time number 4 at Google. And when I was writing the No A Blank Work book, she said, it's not efficient here to be a jerk. You just can't get as much work done. And there was sort of this lovely moment after I gave a talk right after my book came out there. A woman walked up to me and she said, actually, I'm a jerk. I'm a very difficult person, but I've learned I have to be nicer to people here than I usually am because otherwise I can't get my work done. So she sort of confirmed that at least 5 or 6 years ago at Google, that this notion that you couldn't act like that, otherwise you couldn't get your work done. To me, that's like the highest level of the rule actually operating.
To try to kind of pin this down a little bit, specifically, how do you recognize an A word?
There's kind of two approaches I would describe it sort of even in the academic literature. There are people who make lists of all the bad behaviors that people could take. In fact, there was one list by one academic I saw who listed 100 different bullying behaviors, everything from ignoring people to insulting them to actually physically hitting them. So you could have a very long list. The way that I tend to define it, because it's simpler, is that somebody who leaves you feeling demeaned and de-energized, that's somebody I would label as a jerk. And somebody who does that to everybody in different situation, I would call that person a certified jerk, certified A.
For example, tell me about some you've known. You must have worked with a few.
Yes, I think we all have worked with a few. And I guess I should back up here slightly. The research on bullying and jerks is sort of fascinating because it depends on the survey, but some 30 or 40% of Americans, maybe 15% at any one time, will say that they work with or for a jerk. But only about one half of 1% of us will admit being certified jerks or bullying others. So there's a lot of self-servingness here. So I may have been a jerk and deserved it in some cases. And I also have to be careful because remember, I'm tenured in an institution where I'm with people for a very long time. But yes, in various situations, I have worked with them. I should probably stick to clients since my clients are a little bit more ephemeral, like when I do work with companies. I think of one client in particular who, in every interaction I had with him, in every interaction that I saw him have with other people, well, he actually would complain, this was a professional services firm, that particular person wasn't making enough money, or in my case, every interaction I had with him, he would try to negotiate down the price, and he also would personally insult the person in every interaction. And also, he'd do this thing where he'd always stand over people and sort of grab them and kind of push them down. I thought he was pretty much the full package. And I remember sitting at dinner next to one of his colleagues and describing the effect of his leadership. And he said, well, when I first got here, this firm used to be a lovely blend of economics and humanity. And now it's just all economics all the time, and you are just an object to make us all money. Otherwise, we toss you aside. I thought that guy as sort of the complete package demonstrated somebody who would be certified in public life. If the current media reports are correct, I think Lance Armstrong might be the leading one in our culture right now. I would put Donald Trump in the Hall of Fame. The guy just amazes me. And it's amazing how many people actually like him and admire him. And maybe it does help him be successful. There might be situations where you're successful. And we could quickly move to the famous or infamous Steve Jobs. Jobs, even though clearly many times could be a certified jerk, and one of the advantages and I guess disadvantages of being in the Valley is I know a lot of people who work closely with Steve Jobs and were close friends with him. And they would all say one of the great things about Steve is Steve, although he could be nasty, he was actually pretty good about knowing how to turn it on and off. It's not like he was all jerk all the time. It's sort of like a complicated thing in life to identify them. But to me, the diagnostic is not a bad one, is when people who deal with a person across different settings all say to me, that guy or that woman, because there's plenty of women who qualify, is such a jerk. It's just unbelievable. I think they qualify. Carly Farina, former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, just to throw out a woman's name, clearly would qualify. I cannot use the person's name, but when my book was in galley form, a former HP executive who worked directly with her, I sent him the book, and he sent me back a 3,000-word email. And I'm not joking, it was about 3,000 words that compared Carly's behavior to the various concepts in the book. So I want to make sure and be an equal opportunity labeler of certified jerks. And also I'm very careful to only name public figures to protect us legally.
You know, some of the kinds of behavior you described in people who are famously certified A-words, that's so extreme. I mean, I've worked with some difficult people, but nobody ever to that extreme. And I'm wondering just how big a problem are, you know, these kind of certified jerks in American workplaces. Surely there can't be that many of them.
If you look at sort of surveys, there's some good national bullying surveys. And like I say, it looks like, what, say 10 to 12% of employees at any one time report they're being bullied. And usually they're bullied by their boss, although not always. So it sounds like 10% at any one time would be a reasonable estimate. The other thing is, and I'm also, it's a good thing you brought this up, because you know, it's great to tell the dramatic stories about people throwing things and screaming and spitting at people. And I'm one example of a famous news anchor who flicked a lit cigarette at an employee's hair. Those things just sound great on air. But when you look at some of the most insidious jerks, especially people with power, some of the things they do are much more subtle than that.
Like what?
They'll glare at people. Treating people as if they're invisible is one of the most upsetting things that upsets people. So you just sort of like talk to the highest status person in the room and everybody is treated as invisible. Little subtle interruptions, bits of undermining, backstabbing, things like that.
Now I'm worried that maybe I've done those things.
We've all done those things, I think. That's part of the human condition. I don't think there's any stopping it. That's the other line that I like to say, is that when you read the research on bullying and stuff or stories, it's always like, well, there's those people out there who are jerks and then there's me. Most of us aren't very good at seeing what jerks we are. And I hate to be one of the first to raise my hand, but anybody who knows me well knows that I have my moment where I can certainly be demeaning and leave people de-energized, and I try to stop it. And now when I do it, I sometimes get reminded that I wrote a book about this and I'm breaking my own rule by some of my closer friends. So this notion that, well, I'll use the word assholes are us, I think is a reasonable motto that most of us have to assume that we're capable of doing it to others. The other thing I would say is it isn't all bad. There are some times when leaving people feeling demeaned and de-energized is maybe necessary and strategic and sort of, I guess, in small doses with proper precautions. Mm-hmm. So I'm not completely opposed to it.
So if you find yourself one of the 10% with a toxic or bullying boss, and your company doesn't seem to have a no A-word rule, what do you do?
To me, there's sort of almost like a hierarchy of things. It's sort of like being in a destructive relationship. If you're in a situation where every day you go to work, your boss makes you feel like dirt, demeans, de-energizes you, it's a bad situation for you, the best thing to do is to get out. I mean, lots of evidence from the bullying literature that if you can actually just get out of the situation, that's the best thing you can do. Short of that, sort of going down the hierarchy, I talk about things like, well, if you can't do that, well, maybe can you fight back against that person? So the two things that I sort of recommend there is, number one, document, whether you're talking about a lawsuit or reporting to your human resources department. The first thing they're going to say is, what documentation do you have of the behavior? Save the emails, write notes after the interactions. The other thing, and there's some actually new research that supports this, if you have a bullying boss or in a dysfunctional organization, if you try to fight back by yourself, you're in trouble because they just think you're nuts or you're powerless. To the extent you can form a posse, a group of sort of similar victims to keep notes, you'll be in better shape. One of my favorite examples, there was a woman who actually worked, she was like a dog catcher, an animal control officer, and they had a very abusive boss. She went and complained to her boss's boss. Nothing happened. And then she put together, let's call them the A-hole diaries. Her and her coworkers literally put together this documentation, went to the boss's boss, and their boss, who was a woman, by the way, was gone within 24 hours. So this idea of having a posse and documentation is important. And then the other two things that I tend to sort of advise is that when you're in a situation where you can't quite escape, then finding little ways to avoid contact. One woman I talked to, she's actually a CEO. She had an incredibly abusive board member. And what she told me she used to do was to avoid interaction with him directly. She would do only phone calls with him whenever possible. And she would also mute the phone calls and do her fingernails. And then every now and then take it off a mute and say, yes, I understand. So she didn't actually have to have the contact with him. So finding some little way to detach from people. And the final thing that I tend to recommend is, although we live in a world where people talk about passion and caring and all that sort of stuff, that's wonderful if you have a boss or a workplace that deserves your passion and your efforts. But sometimes in life, we get stuck in situations where we just have to tune out and emotionally detach and just not care and get through it. I use the analogy of about 3 years ago, I bought a ticket very late, and I was in the middle seat of the very last row next to the bathrooms in this huge airplane with the lines around you all the time. And I'm pretty large myself, and I was sitting surrounded by two very large people. So I just pretended I wasn't there for, like, you know, the 4 hours from Chicago to San Francisco. And sometimes in life, you've just got to do the emotional detachment and not care to get through until hopefully you can get to another place. So I guess my hierarchy is learn to detach, fight back, but if you can, possibly get out. Because, and there's a lot of evidence with bad bosses, for example, that people who quit bad bosses are much happier and much more successful. Bad bosses do lots of damage.
Robert Sutton is the author of The No Asshole Rule, Building a Civilized Workplace and Surviving One That Isn't. He spoke with N. Strange Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program, Assholes. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Brittany DeAnda. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.